I'm Matt Miller, and this is Interesting, the show that brings you the people and ideas that are shaping our world. Today, the view from the Tea Party. With the government shut down and Americans fed up, politicians on all sides are pointing fingers. In this high-stakes climate, with anxiety rising in global markets, it may seem a fool's errand to try and have a civil conversation that pushes past the talking points. But we're going to do our best today with a conservative voice that's gaining increasing prominence on the national scene. My guest is Steve King, the Iowa congressman whose district includes Ames, Fort Dodge, Mason City, and Sioux City. King, 64 years old, built a construction business before entering the state Senate in 1996. He was elected to Congress in 2002. The New York Times featured King on page one the other day, calling him, quote, one of the most outspoken advocates for blocking Obamacare, even if that means shutting down the government or defaulting on the national debt. Welcome, Congressman. Thanks for taking the time.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on. I appreciate it, Matt.
I don't know if it's a badge of honor to be on page one for the New York Times for you or how you'd view that, but it certainly is another marker of your the significance of your voice in the debate. What I hope to do is to get past the blame game, which is going around Washington now, obviously, to the underlying policy issues, because that's what you and your colleagues have wanted to force a discussion on. Let's talk for a minute about the uninsured. According to National Journal, about 9% of the population of your district is uninsured. That's below the national average of 15%, so maybe it's not quite as pressing back home for your folks. But still, not 9% of, I guess, 600,000 people in your district is 50, 55,000 Iowans that you would represent without coverage. Is that a public policy problem in your view?
Well, I don't think it is when you look at that number and you analyze the intent of the president, Nancy Pelosi, and Harry Reid, when they pushed Obamacare through. They always admitted that there were going to be at least, well, they didn't always admit it, but it was part of their data, that there were going to be at least 4% of the population that was uninsured, even with Obamacare. And you've given me a number of 9%. I don't have any reason to support or disagree with that number. It seems reasonable to me. But I remember a chart that was delivered by the Senate Republican staff during that period of time, well vetted, and I turned it into a pie chart, and it was this. We had the number of 300 plus million people in America. They argued that there were 48 million, it's 48 million that were uninsured. And so then you start subtracting from that those who have insurance offered to them by their employer and don't accept it, those who qualified for Medicaid and didn't sign up, those that are in the United States illegally or otherwise didn't qualify because of their immigration status. And so it keeps subtracting from that 48 million people. It got down to 12.1 million people who were uninsured without affordable options. That turns out to be 4% of the population. So this 9%, since we're a higher insured population than many of the other districts, it has to include those people who qualify for Medicaid, those who didn't sign up with their employer, those who make over $75,000 a year and presumably can afford their own insurance. So this is it's a number that I think we have to be objective about this, and that is that I'm gonna speculate now. It looks to me like the direction that Obamacare is going, if implemented the way it's structured with all the waivers that the president has put out there, is likely going to leave more people uninsured than if Obamacare had never passed in the first place.
That seems like a difficult claim to make, because while it's clear that Obamacare by its own terms is not going to cover all the uninsured, and I know there are fights about the 40 to 50 million number, but Obamacare by its own terms would, maybe it'll cover 20 to 30, but still leave 20 million out. But I guess as in the policy question, what I want folks to understand, I'd like to hear you speak to, is it is true that America is the only wealthy nation where people can still go bankrupt, be financially ruined if someone in their family falls seriously ill. Is that's what's, I think, driving on the center left side of this debate, that drives the impulse to try and find ways to extend coverage. And I think folks on that side have trouble understanding why you and your colleagues wouldn't agree that that's something that's shameful in a country as wealthy as the U.S. How do you view that?
Well, I would say first that everybody in America, before this debate even began, had access to health care. This debate, in the language of health care and health insurance, was conflated by people who wanted to advance a program that their goal was single-payer, socialized medicine. So they conflated the two terms of health insurance and health care to the point now where Republicans often don't realize they're saying health care when they mean health insurance. And of those who have who are the bankruptcy question that you have, those who had pre-existing conditions, I mean, the reason, if you take away the pre-existing condition component of Obamacare, you end up with a situation where most of the states, Iowa included, and I believe the number is 37 states, have a high-risk pool where the taxpayers buy down that premium for those who don't have insurance that find themselves, you know, with pre-existing conditions. So that's been a solution that's been provided by a majority of the states, and that's a far better solution than to put everybody under one government program and end up with what will ultimately be rationing services, rationing care, doctors who are dispirited by this, and taking the market essentially out of this. And I have a letter from a constituent that is a cancellation of his policy. And, of course, the promise, if you like your policy, you get to keep it. Well, he surely doesn't. And his premium, they say, if you don't find another policy, we'll automatically sign you up January 1st. This is Blue Cross Blue Shield. And your premium goes up 365%, and your deductible goes from $2,000 to over $6,000. That's what's going on all over this country. And I think that those who end up uninsured because of those kind of price increases, 365%, and that's not the most extreme, there will be people dropping insurance, paying the penalty, and if that number gets to about 8 million people out of these 316 million, you're back where we started with the same number of uninsured after Obamacare that we have going into it.
Well, a couple of thoughts on that. I mean, first, Dean, I've studied the health insurance markets for a long time, and while the idea of a high-risk pool in theory would be one way to deal with folks who are unlucky and have medical illnesses in their family that make them essentially uninsurable, the fact is that in virtually all the states, those are kind of stepchild, underfunded programs with long wait lists and not enough funding to accommodate the people who who would need to avail themselves of that. So why isn't it? I mean, I've talked over the years with conservatives. I mean, the idea of using something like the structure of not single payer, which obviously, as you know, is not what Obamacare is, but using the subsidies for folks to have access to private health coverage, that was originally the conservative solution that would actually preserve market forces in the system, but still find a way to move toward universal coverage in ways that were supposed to honor market values. Why wasn't that an acceptable approach? It's what Romney did in Massachusetts. Its original pedigree was my friend Stuart Butler from the Heritage Foundation, all in the wake of ClintonCare going down when both sides were looking for ways that might be able to get kind of a cross-party consensus without the overreach that the conservatives had worried about. Why did that end up not being acceptable to you to the point where you're talking, you know, you've used very tough language, economic havoc, you know, free people from the bondage of Obamacare. Nobody doubts that single payer and Medicare is single payer, is constitutional. So why wasn't this an acceptable middle way?
Well, I don't think anybody doubts that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, their objective is single payer. Barack Obama said,
But that's not what the law is.
I want to make sure people understand their intent and what they tried to do. And so we ended up with something that was less than that because that was all they could get that the Democrats to vote for. This is a purely partisan piece of legislation. It has nothing but Democrats that advanced it.
But you don't deny that Mitt Romney's plan was the model and that the Heritage Foundation, I mean, it's a fact. They were the earlier kind of counselors who had laid out what this kind of a market-based model to extend private insurance would be. Do you deny that?
I'm not here to argue Romney's plan. The only thing I really know about that is what got brought out in the debate and when those allegations were made by the people who support Barack Obama. But I will say this, I believe that it was a philosophical mistake for some of the strategists, wherever they might have come from, to argue that we needed to have guaranteed issue. Because the only way that you can get to guaranteed issue is that you have to then compel people to sign up for insurance.
Right.
That is mandatory insurance. So the individual mandate came in to take care of the guaranteed issue piece. And that was the philosophical error. It's far better solutions to let the markets decide this and let the states continue, however you want to say whether they were unfunded or not within the states. I mean, I chaired a committee that had oversight over this for several years in the Iowa Senate, and I would know if Iowa was short on that. Yes, we heard complaints. People always say the premiums are too high, but people could get insurance and they were cared for. And this Obamacare upsets the entire health care system in the United States, all to get at some people that are uninsured. And when you get down to that number of those who are uninsured without affordable options, that was 12.1 million people. and that's it. That's 4% of the population. We're not going to improve that, even according to the people who are advancing Obamacare. But what we will be doing and are doing is upsetting the entire insurance system in the United States, and we're upsetting the entire healthcare delivery system in the United States. It is a government takeover of something that people hold sacred, and that is our health. To take the management of individuals' health out of their hands and put it in control of the federal government, it's an appalling thing when you think about the uniqueness of the spirit of American God-given liberties.
See, this is what I don't understand, Congressman. Medicare is a much more has a much bigger government role, obviously, than what the Obamacare proposal is, like the Romney Care proposal. So if you see Obamacare as a kind of unacceptable intrusion by the federal government into some kind of sacred, healthcare situation, doesn't that mean Medicare by definition is do you want to repeal Medicare? That's what I'm not understanding, the logic of that.
Well, if I was advocating for repealing Medicare, I would just say so. But
you understand what I'm saying. If Obamacare is being characterized as this unacceptable government intrusion, it's got much more market forces in it. It's using private insurers. Medicare is obviously a single-payer program for seniors.
Let's deal with this. Medicare is institutionalized. Social Security is institutionalized. However, the entitlement factors of them threaten to sink our budget. So there's no reason for us to add another entitlement on this that cannot meet the promises that were made by the President of the United States who attached his name to it. And this is at least $1 trillion in additional deficit spending. It's probably closer to $2 trillion in additional deficit spending. And it expands the dependency class in America and takes away this vigorous spirit of America. So we're going to have to address the entitlements of Medicare and Social Security and this entitlement of Medicaid at some point. And right now, we're pinned down playing defense when the president and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid gave us this purely partisan piece of legislation that's threatening to roll over American liberty. So we have to fight the battle that's in front of us. And then at the same time, we've got to be planning on how we're going to deal with bringing this the other entitlements under our control so we don't get sunk economically. That's the battle we have. It's going to be a long-term battle, and you've got to take them one at a time. But I don't suggest that we repeal Medicare at all, nor Social Security. Let's hold those in place, but let's manage them so that we can get our budget under control. What I'm for is a balanced budget amendment to our Constitution, one that's legitimate, one that's responsible, and one that will restrain future Congresses, because I don't think that the culture in this town will get us to balance. And if it does, I don't think it'll keep us at balance without a balanced budget amendment to our Constitution.
How do you make, and I do want to point out so listeners understand that at least the Congressional Budget Office says that Obamacare will, when the dust clears, insure another 20 or 25 million Americans, which is at odds with what I think Representative King is saying. And they say that because of the taxes in it versus the expenditures, it would actually, at least in the 10-year window, put some deficit reduction in. So there's a bit of a clash there. But one thing, again, this is on the kind of liberty question. When I talk to business leaders in Canada and Europe, people who are, entrepreneurs who are kind of describe themselves as capitalists, maybe not quite as cowboy, like you as the U.S., but they're, people who built businesses, they are mystified by the healthcare debate in the U.S. because in their view, it's government's role to provide some kind of basic health security for citizens, and they don't understand why it ends up in the U.S. And these are business leaders who are capitalists who've built businesses and say, why are you guys, having all this kind of coming to a clash in a government shutdown over government having some basic role in providing basic health security? How would you answer them? You're an entrepreneur. You were an entrepreneur yourself, right?
Well, yes, and here's my answer. It sounds to me like your Canadian friends have already lost their ability to think freely and think outside the box. They're in the box of socialized medicine in Canada. And I remember when it was implemented in Canada, and I have business associates from up there, and I recall meeting with them, and here's the narrative they told me. And one of them said to me, boy, it's great. My wife broke her ankle. We took her to the hospital. It didn't cost a penny. She was well taken care of. And then you start hearing the other stories about waiting for a knee or a hip replacement and then they would say, but a good employment policy in Canada includes an alternative health insurance policy that if you need heart surgery, they'll fly you to Houston for that heart surgery. But here's the real narrative that I think illustrates what is going on. They said the first year that the Canadian healthcare policy went in place, people would go to the clinics and schedule their appointments and wait. But and then after that, they started going when it was convenient for them at the emergency rooms and putting pressure on the emergency personnel. They said it's the equivalent of this, that the first year that the boss has a Christmas party and buys you a dinner, people will come in and they'll have one or two drinks, eat a nice meal, and say nice things about the boss. By about the third year, it's an entitlement to them. Then they go in and they get drunk and they start telling bad stories about the boss. That's kind of what they explained to me has happened within Canada. And if you don't have any experience of being able to manage your own health, go out there and demand that the market produce a policy that fits you and millions of others, then your ability to manage your own health, to actually think about it, has disappeared because you don't have the experience with the freedom that we have here in America, or had here in America, as the case may be.
You're listening to This Is Interesting from KCRW. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or listen on the KCRW mobile app. I'm Matt Miller, and I'm talking with Steve King about the healthcare fight and the shutdown in Washington. Now, it's funny because the Canadian, maybe we're talking to different Canadian capitalists, but the, and by the way, I'm not making a plug for single payer here because, as you know, Switzerland and Holland, they do something like what the Romney Care, Obamacare design is with, subsidized private insurance, and folks are mandated to hold some coverage. But we do have, I think no one would dispute, we have the most private sector involvement in healthcare in the U.S. of the wealthy nations, but we're also the most radically inefficient. Right, we're spending 18% of GDP. The rest of the world is spending 10 to 12. Singapore, which actually has an interesting hybrid of market forces, personal responsibility, and public sector involvement, spends 4% of GDP and has, by a lot of measures, as good or better health outcomes than us. How do we get rid of the kind of radical inefficiency? That's basically the driver of, I understand there's Social Security tweaks as the population ages that ought to be discussed to slow its growth, but Medicare is really the kind of 800-pound gorilla in the room, and the or elephant in the room. And when we're so radically inefficient compared to these other countries, is there a short list of benevolent dictator Steve King reforms that would get that under control?
Boy, that's a loaded question, Matt. I've been to Singapore, and I see what they have there. That's an island 12 miles by 17 miles, and some have said it's a fascist state. For the example there, I wonder why there are no people out there with tin cups on the street asking for money. And I finally got the answer, and it was because if they go out and beg on the street, a couple of policemen come by, pick him up and take him to the nursing home, and they say he can empty bedpans if he can hold out a tin cup. That's exactly what came to me from the Singaporeans. And by the way, you can't talk politics in Singapore unless you're a member of a political party, of which there's only one, and it has to be within 30 days of the election. So they can put some efficiencies in. That dictatorship, I don't believe, is particularly benevolent. We're a free society, and we have to let free markets happen. We have to expand personal liberty rather than diminish personal liberty. If we diminish personal liberty, and there are times we do that for safety and security. For example, security around the Capitol is one of those things that personal liberty has been diminished, but security has been trade-off for security. But we need to be expanding our liberty. We need a robust, vigorous society of entrepreneurs that can solve this. And let's let the marketplace, the forces, come to this place. There are many things that are clutters in the way. And because I want to repeal all of Obamacare, and I want to start over. And it's a tragedy that we're going to have a decade that we've lost the opportunity to put the right policies in place. But a simple one is this: allow people to sell insurance across state lines. Repeal the significant portions of McCarran-Ferguson so that can happen. Let me buy insurance from Kentucky or Alabama or wherever, and let everybody in America do the same thing. That drives these prices down, and it gives almost everybody access to insurance. And by the way, let's expand our health savings accounts instead of essentially cut them down to less than half as Obamacare did. Let's let people put money into that health savings account, even the way we passed it in 2003 as a part of Part D. Even with that, you would take a young couple that could have signed up then, say at age 20, and maxed out in their health savings account. And if you compound that at the historical interest average and take $2,000 out a year for real medical costs, they would arrive at retirement age with approximately $950,000 in their health savings account. The federal government's interest in that is tax it as ordinary income when it comes out of the HSA. Why wouldn't we say to them, that's tax-free to you, if you buy a Medicare replacement policy upon retirement, you can keep the change tax-free, travel the world, use it as a retirement fund. If we do that, then we have people that step up by the millions, and they have a life management account that they manage, that they own, and they make prudent decisions about their health and about their savings, about their diet, about their exercise, because they're going to want to spend that money. We can do far better with what we're doing, but the argument that I get from the people on the left is, well, everybody can't do that. So they'll argue, if everybody can't do that, then nobody should be allowed to. That's like, you know, no longer giving out any blue ribbons at the county fair, just participation.
How about this as a deal? Let's say I'm trying to think of what is a, you know, a productive deal that Obama could answer the call to negotiate, that Republicans could accept. What if Obama said, you know what, I don't like this, but I'm going to let, so we can resolve this once and for all, I will offer to let any state that wants to come forward and ask for a waiver that would let them use all the federal monies for Obamacare, Medicaid, you know, the federal monies coming into healthcare into that state to be used by that state. Maybe Republican governors would take them up on this. So long as they offer a universal catastrophic plan in that state, maybe with some other special funding, you know, through a health savings account for preventive care, universal catastrophic, something like that. So Obama will show flexibility and get Republicans to honor the principle of covering everyone. Republicans will be able to say, you know what, we've slayed the beast of Obamacare as the one-size-fits-all model and given the states the ability to show there are different models that are arguably more cost-effective because it would be starting with catastrophic. And also claim that they had shown some real change in the structure of Obama's health care plan for all their troubles. And maybe as part of that, we'd agree to, you know, put the debt limit aside and not have a debt limit anymore, because, as you know, we're like the only country except for Denmark, I think, that has one, which becomes this forcing device that, you know, for understandable reasons, both sides try and seize on, although I'd argue you guys are a bit more extreme in the way you're trying to do that. But what about that kind of a health care waiver, universal catastrophic is the condition for states that want it to use the federal money?
Well, fiscally responsible, just this is the last couple of years is the first time I've heard that described as extreme. We should have a balanced budget, and the debt ceiling is one of the tools we must have. But you've made an interesting point here, and I would want to look through that policy of the catastrophic coverage to see how many mandates are attached to that. Would it be catastrophic coverage, but it still has to have maternity, for example, and does it have to have mental health? Does it have to have, go right down through the list of those mandates that are on there, and I would take a look at it, though. And here's another thing that we could look at.
Yeah, because maybe we could make it so the states could do it without as many mandates, and then you'd have a little more state experimentation. But the principle of universal catastrophic, so no one could go broke from being ill, that would be done in America.
Well, so we can do that through the bankruptcy court, too. Mm. That would be another way of doing that. But when you say universal catastrophic, that means universal coverage. Universal coverage means federal mandate. You must buy insurance. That troubles a lot of constitutional conservatives, because the federal government has never before required that its citizens purchase a product that's either produced or approved by the federal government. That's galling to a free people. And so that part, I philosophically, I hit a barrier there. But I think that, you know, as functionality is concerned, you propose something here that's worth discussion. And here's another component of this, another way of looking at it. This is clearly the other side of the table, and it's probably going to surprise you a little bit, Matt. But if we get to this point where we can't reach an agreement and we're just at a stalemate, and all of these things that are good about Obamacare is being asserted by the other side, and then I would say, all right, let's put on the table this idea. We would repeal all of the mandates repeal all of the waivers that the president has provided to all the groups that he's provided the waivers to, those that can be excused under the waiver authority of civilians and others. He's unconstitutionally, he has exempted members of Congress and their staff from the application of Obamacare, and he's unconstitutionally extended the employer mandate for a year. That's a specific language in the law. We put that all back in and say, now make it work. You've got a year to make it work. And we want to make sure we have an election so that the people can weigh in. And then here's all of Obamacare or nothing. And we'll extend it until January 15th of 2015, but sunset it at that point. Then the Congress elected in November of 2014 would have to reauthorize Obamacare, or it would expire. that would give a full year to put that out there. We could actually have a national debate, a national election over it. And that I'm willing to push all of those chips in the middle of the table, because I think we're at a stalemate here now that eventually, you know, it's going to break its way out. But we're missing the opportunities to continue with research and development and to improve our healthcare system. And we need to continue to lead the world.
Just a little bit of time left. I still prefer my deal, but I hear your deal. So, yeah, what do you say to Republicans who've been criticizing you and your colleagues who have kind of taken this to the mat in this way? You know, the John McCains and others who say this is the suicide vest and the suicide caucus. I think Charles Krauthammer, the Washington Post, my colleague, called it. What, you know, there's a lot of internal Republican criticism that you guys are playing a dangerous game for the party. What's your response?
Well, my answer to this is that, you know, there's been those who look back and they say in the 17 other shutdowns in history, you know, the House will always lose when they confront the president. I look at those numbers and I don't see that at all. I mean, there were 5 shutdowns under Jimmy Carter, and actually 4 of them were about abortion. 39 out of the 8 of the 54 days the government was shut down under Jimmy Carter. By the way, that was Democrats fighting with Democrats. Were about abortion. Jimmy Carter didn't want to fund it. The Democrats did. And so that was an interesting piece of history that's not conclusive necessarily. Jimmy Carter didn't come out of that very well. When you go to the Reagan era, 8 shutdowns, Tip O'Neill, in my analysis, prevailed in 4 of them. 3 were kind of undecided, jump balls or dead heat, and Ronald Reagan prevailed in 1 of them. So then you go to the shutdowns that took place in 95 and 96. The Republican majority won the first one, and the second one, the long one that we're focusing on here. They say that Republicans lost, but we got a balanced budget out of the deal in 4 years, that we had a surplus of revenue coming in. We got welfare reform. Good things came out of it. And if there was a political penalty, it didn't show up in any stark way. So I think that whatever any kind of political penalty, if it exists at all, and I don't think it does, I think we adapt to that. We adjust to that. But we can never recover from Obamacare if it's ever fully implemented. That's the principle we're standing on here. And I think that's the cooler heads actually saying there's a long-term view for America. We have to maintain it, our constitutional authority. We have to maintain the American vitality, this American ascendancy in our destiny and the arc of history is going to be diminished if we allow Obamacare to be fully implemented, and we'll never achieve the level of greatness that we would otherwise.
Last question for 30 seconds. What do you say to analysts who say what you and your colleagues most fear is that if Obamacare is implemented, the reason you're making this stand now is it will end up being, when we get past these glitches, it will end up being popular, just as the Medicare prescription drug plan was popular, because low-income workers will find that they can have access to insurance in ways that they were kind of uniquely left out in our system before. If you're poor enough, you're on Medicaid. If you're a senior, you're on you're on Medicare. If you've got an employer who offers it, you get it from your job. But there's a large class of low-income workers who've been shut out. They will like this. What do you say to those who say you're afraid this will work?
Well, if it works, I'm not afraid. But what I'm afraid is, I'm afraid that people will essentially just give up. And they will think, the government has ordered me to do this. I have to live under it. Some will just drop out of the system and deal with the health care issue when they have a health problem. And others will tap into the revenue that they've got and write that check that's 365% premium increase. That takes away from the other budget, and it's hard to, you know, it is hard on the economy when you take money out of the one sector to put it into another. It's not that I'm worried about it working. I'm worrying about the spirit of the American people that might just collapse and live in dependency. We have a lot stronger spirit than they have in places like Western Europe. We've seen how the socialism of Western Europe has diminished the robustness of their economy. And, you know, another thing is that I walk into the churches over there and they're now museums. They don't have the spirit of the people that built those great countries, especially in Western Europe. There are different people today than they were then. They've been through a lot of different things than we have. But we're a unique civilization. We're a unique culture of people. This American vitality cannot be replicated anywhere else. It's precious. And we have an obligation to protect it and defend it, enhance it and grow it for our posterity and for the future of the entire world, because we have to lead. If Western Christendom, as Winston Churchill called it, is to grow and expand, and if the philosophy that grew out of the age of reason is going to dominate this world with free enterprise, is going to continue to give the gift that it's given to these economies around the world, America has to hold and stay strong. And if we give up and say, well, we don't have any other way to do this except socialized medicine eventually, and we're going to have a managed economy, then we descend into the depths of the rest of the world. We are not, as Americans, also-rans. We are the unchallenged greatest nation in the world. There's a uniqueness about it. And our obligation is to preserve, protect, and defend it. And that's certainly my goal, Matt.
We're going to have to leave it there. Steve King, thank you very much for taking the time. An able and articulate spokesman for this point of view. We may not agree on everything, but I really appreciate your engaging on the substance. We didn't even get to the Tea Party diet. Coming soon to a coming soon. If the government can slim down, so can you. Bound to be a bestseller. Thanks for taking the time, Congressman.
Let's take that up next time, Matt. I look forward to it.
Very good. Gary Scott and Laura Dine Milliam produced today's show. Our technical director is Melissa Morton. Let us know what you found interesting at kcrw.com/thisisinteresting. I'm Matt Miller. Find the show on demand on the KCRW mobile app or wherever you download podcasts. Thanks for listening, and join us again soon for another edition of This is Interesting.